Hello there. Today is Tuesday, August the 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, what's next for action against the North Korean threat? What plants in Antarctica can do to help prevent sunburn? President Donald Trump is on a working vacation. Hear what he's up to. Also ahead, we hear about a country singer having some personal issues. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said on Monday the best step for North Korea could be to signal it's ready for dialogue would be to stop its missile tests.
We're not going to give someone a specific number of days or weeks. This is really about the spirit of these talks, and they can demonstrate they're ready to sit with a spirit of finding a way forward in these talks by no longer conducting these missile tests. So this is not give me 30 days and we're ready to talk. It's not quite that simple.
Speaking from Manila, where he's taking part in the regional forum of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, Tillerson said Saturday's UN Security Council vote unanimously adopting new sanctions against North Korea sends a message that the entire international community finds the country's actions unacceptable. Joining me now for more on this tense situation is Kelsey Davenport, Director for Nonproliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association. So in its first major response to the sanctions, North Korea threatened retaliation, saying the U.S. would pay dearly thousands of times. How seriously should the U.S. take this threat, Kelsey?
Well, whenever you analyze statements coming out of North Korea, it's critical to remember that Pyongyang is often playing to its domestic base in addition to an international audience. So these threats of retaliation against the United States are largely designed for domestic purposes, because the regime in North Korea is rational. It does realize that any attack on the United States, any overt aggression against the United States, is going to generate a response. And North Korea certainly does not want to end up in a conflict with the United States, because that would likely mean the end of its regime. Now, in terms of North Korea's statements about not giving up its nuclear weapons, you know, North Korea is likely looking at examples like Libya and Iraq, where these dictators gave up their weapons of mass destruction programs and eventually were overthrown. So Pyongyang is going to be looking for some security guarantees from the United States and others in the region before it's willing to talk. And that's one reason why the United States should consider an interim agreement with North Korea that might just freeze advances on their programs. That would prevent North Korea's nuclear and missile programs from advancing and build time for a longer deal.
Well, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson at the Regional Security Forum in Manila seemed to open the door to dialogue. Tillerson's comments, though, did seem to indicate a softening tone. Are we getting a mixed message, or is this a new strategy? What is your view on this?
Secretary of State Tillerson's comments certainly keep open the door for talks with North Korea. But what will be critical now is if the United States reinforces that message. And over the past 6 months of the Trump presidency, Washington has sent a lot of mixed signals to North Korea, both about its willingness to talk and about the preconditions that would be required of North Korea in order to engage.
So, will sanctions work alone?
Well, sanctions alone are not a strategy. Sanctions can certainly generate pressure on North Korea, but sanctions work most effectively when they're paired with diplomacy, because negotiations offer a country then the opportunity to give something up in order to obtain sanctions relief. So right now, pursuing sanctions alone in a vacuum is not going to get North Korea to change its behavior. It's not going to alter Pyongyang's nuclear and missile ambitions. And that's why it's critical to pair sanctions with diplomacy going forward. And right now, the United States has a huge diplomacy deficit when it comes to reaching out to North Korea.
Well, we have seen a lot of tough talk from the president toward North Korea, and we've heard reports in recent months that a preemptive strike could potentially be the only option available. How likely is something like that to happen?
Well, this talk amongst U.S. officials about a preventative strike or preemptive strike on North Korea is certainly very dangerous. You know, it also sends a message to North Korea that its regime might be under threat, an unprovoked attack from the United States, which is going to make North Korea even less likely to want to negotiate and really focus on the diplomatic piece at this time.
And then there's China. The president has publicly called China out on Twitter for not doing enough. Does China have the will to do something, and is it wise for the president to be tweeting displeasure with China?
Well, making policy as complex as a nuclear negotiation or an approach to North Korea doesn't lend itself well to being resolved on Twitter. And the United States certainly should not be trying to provoke China at this time. Washington is going to need Beijing's cooperation to come up with a policy to approach North Korea, to engage them in talks. And China's support for negotiations will certainly be helpful. But what the United States can't do is continue to think that it can outsource the North Korea problem to China. And China alone is not going to be able to solve this crisis. North Korea wants to negotiate with the United States. So we can't think that China alone is going to solve this problem. But there are some positive steps from China. You know, China did support new UN Security Council sanctions on North Korea. That's certainly positive. And China has issued several statements recently condemning North Korea's missile tests and calling them to refrain from further provocative actions. So the United States should really be looking for opportunities to work with China to come up with an approach to engage North Korea that Beijing is willing to support, because that will increase the chances of success for a negotiated settlement.
All right. Well, we certainly do appreciate your perspective. That's Kelsey Davenport, Director for Nonproliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Kenyan President Kenyatta urges calm on Election Day. Mental illness is on the rise in Pakistan's tribal region in the wake of terror attacks. 9/11 victims remains identified some 16 years later. And a 3D version of Michael Jackson's Thriller is set for debut. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump is spending the next few weeks on a, quote, working vacation at his resort in New Jersey. But before leaving, he worked to rally his supporters, even as the probe into possible collusion between his presidential campaign and Russia heats up. Trump held a campaign-style rally in West Virginia last week as he battles low poll numbers and a stalled congressional agenda. But as VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports from Washington, there are signs of Republican discontent with the president.
Back among the faithful, Donald Trump sought to counter the notion that he's presiding over a floundering administration.
Americans of every kind are coming together with one simple goal: make America great again.
Trump lashed out at the ongoing Russia investigation, dismissing it as a total fabrication.
We didn't win because of Russia. We won because of you. That I can tell you. They're trying to cheat you out of the leadership you want with a fake story that is demeaning to all of us, and most importantly, demeaning to our country and demeaning to our Constitution.
Trump's rally was held as reports circulated that special counsel Robert Mueller has convened a grand jury to hear evidence in the Russia probe. The president still draws enthusiastic crowds, but continues to struggle in national polls. Trump is down to only 33% approval in the latest Quinnipiac University survey, a new low. Trump is also slipping among members of his own party, said Tim Malloy via Skype.
And of course, Republicans side with him. But that number now is on like in the 70s, and it was up in the 90s. So he's losing Republicans.
That's evident in the strained relationship between the president and the Republican congressional majority, especially in the wake of the Senate failure on health care. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell rejected Trump's call to eliminate the parliamentary tactic known as the filibuster.
There are not the votes in the Senate, as I've said repeatedly to the president and to all of you, to change the rules of the Senate.
Trump signed a Russia sanctions bill into law after it received strong bipartisan support in both the House and Senate. But he also issued a tweet blaming Congress for the poor state of relations with Russia, prompting pushback from Republican Senator Bob Corker.
We acted, I think, in the country's national interest in doing this. Putin, through his actions, is the one that has taken this relationship back to levels we haven't seen since 1991.
Trump's combative nature motivates his opponents, but also still plays well with his base, says analyst Kyle Condick.
He campaigned as a very unconventional, kind of rough around the edges candidate, and he hasn't really changed that since he's been in office.
Both the president and Congress are taking a break from Washington. Lawmakers are off on their August recess, while Trump begins a 17-day vacation at his golf resort in New Jersey. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the World Health Organization reports that there are between 2 and 3 million cases of melanoma skin cancer reported every year. Sunscreen is a big part of preventing these cancers, but chemical-laden sunscreens have their drawbacks. That's why scientists are now scouring the natural world to understand how plants protect themselves from damaging ultraviolet rays. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Antarctica isn't exactly awash in biodiversity, but there are plenty of plants and animals that call this coldest of continents home. Chilean scientists are studying some of these plants to see how they react to the relentless summertime of damaging ultraviolet rays.
And we have found that both species are tolerant of ultraviolet radiation.
Zuniga is studying these plants to find out how they shrug off the barrage of UV rays that causes skin cancer in humans. The hope is that the same compounds protecting the plants can also protect humans.
Specifically, in the case of Colombanthus, we identified a group of molecules that act as solar filters, and that is very interesting because, of course, one understands that given the environment in which the plant develops, in the spring-summer, the radiation levels are very high. The plant has strategies to avoid the damage that this radiation generates.
Since the industrial age, loss of the ozone layer has increased the amount of UV reaching the Earth by 30%, according to NASA, though that level has stabilized in recent years. Zuniga's research could also have implications for plants as a way to protect them and increase crop yields.
This allows us also to understand how the plants respond to the ultraviolet radiation, thinking that this information could be used in the not-too-distant future and be incorporated into plants of agronomic interest that are susceptible to ultraviolet radiation.
Zuniga and the university are currently looking for partners that will help them develop products based on their research. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA. VOA.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
Thank you.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, anyone who's done a lot of air travel over the years has felt the squeeze on planes. It's not just that flights are getting more crowded. It's a problem that a federal judge is now asking the U.S. Aviation Administration to look into what he calls the case of the incredible shrinking airline seat. Joining me now for more on this is Dallas-based aviation attorney Will Angeli. So is this in response to this lawsuit filed by a passenger's rights group?
Well, according to the Flyers Rights Education Fund, who apparently has tracked some of this, seat sizes are actually getting a little bit smaller. He cited some studies that show that over the last 20 years or so, the seat pitch, which is the distance between the top of one seat and the top of the one front or behind it, has shrank from 35 inches to 31 inches, and some planes are as low as 28 inches. And then seat width over that same period has gone from 18.5 inches to 17 inches on average. So I think they are adding some seats, and to do that, you know, they've got to make some of these seats smaller.
So the group is asserting that the seats are shrinking and it's putting passenger safety at risk, is my understanding?
Yes, and procedurally what happened is this group petitioned the FAA to look at it and engage in rulemaking, for one thing, to try to stop the seats from shrinking anymore, but two, to try to, you know, have some rules in place that would maybe enlarge them or address this issue somehow. The FAA received the petition and then declined to act on it, saying that there was no safety issue present, you know, imminent safety issue. And this whole case sort of brings up, you know, the FAA has a conflicting dual role, which is it has to regulate safety and at the same time commerce of aviation, and sometimes those two things butt heads. But in this particular instance, the FAA said it's not anything we need to address at this time. So what happened is Flyers Rights then appealed that administrative decision by the FAA to the U.S. Court of Appeals for District of Columbia, which has oversight on such things. So you just go straight from the FAA to the circuit court. And then the circuit court reviewed it and basically broke it down into two broad areas. One, with regard to passenger ingress and especially egress in emergency situations. If the seats are too narrow, then it's going to make it difficult to get out of the plane in an emergency. And then two, the general health and, you know, well-being of the passengers while flying, which is to say, you know, are we getting stiffer and number and, you know, muscle aches and joint aches, and then also on long flights, deep vein thrombosis, which has been known to occur. The Court of Appeals basically reviewed it and said, you know, when the FAA addressed the ingress-egress issue, you know, they didn't have enough of an evidentiary basis for making that determination. The FAA cited some studies, and the court noted a lot of the studies had been done in the 2000s when seats were actually bigger and, you know, average person size is actually a little bit smaller. And then some of the studies the FAA cited, they said were proprietary, and so they couldn't give them to the court. And so the court said, well, we can't evaluate the evidentiary basis of evidence that's not in front of us. So basically what the Court of Appeals did was remand that part back to the FAA and said, hey, guys, you didn't do a good enough job of supporting your decision. Take a look at it and do it again. And then on the general health and well-being aspect, they agreed with the FAA and said, the FAA basically said, we'll monitor it. We think it's an issue. We're going to see if there's anything that needs to be done in the future, but we don't think there's anything that needs to be done right now. And the Court of Appeals said, well, that's good enough. And so they denied the Flyers' Rights petition on that front. So basically what's happened is just that one piece has gone back to the FAA for further evaluation.
It seems like, though, now you have to pay more for legroom. There are airlines that say, well, if you want more legroom, then, you know, you can upgrade. It's sort of mind-boggling to think that this is where we are.
Yes, and it's one of those problems that, you know, ordinarily you vote with your feet, right? I mean, if you didn't like one airline, you'd go to one that gives you a little bit more room, but they all seem to be going in this direction. So ultimately, it may come to a point where the FAA is forced, you know, either through a petition like this or through Congress. I noticed that there had been a bill in the Senate sponsored by several senators, Schumer and Blumenthal, to name a couple, to try to force the FAA to regulate this, and it failed in the larger Senate. So I think it's an issue that's brewing. It's just not quite there yet.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Dallas-based aviation attorney Will Angeli. Thank you. Well, turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, if you're like me, and pretty much like anyone on social media, you've posted something online that's been embarrassing, or you wish you wouldn't have posted, or you wish you could take back, but the internet being what it is, once it goes up on the internet, it stays on the internet. Nothing really ever disappears from the internet. However, mm-hmm. that might be changing soon.
Really?
Because there's a new law proposed in the UK that would allow people to remove their online data permanently that they don't want people to see. So this is something that the UK Parliament has been considering as part of their data protection laws. It would allow people to erase parts of themselves from the internet. Now, this is not a new thing. This has happened before. Back in 2014, a man in Spain sued Google for the right to be forgotten, and that's a phrase that people have used a lot, the right to be forgotten. And the court in that case said, yeah, Google doesn't have to include his search results or include this information that he wants removed in its search results. And thousands of people now have gone to Google and other search engines and said, hey, I want to remove this result that I don't want showing up. So this could take it a whole other step, however, because it could remove things that you've posted versus things that other people have posted about you or put up online about you. So it is essentially giving more power to the people. And that's part of the trend that we're seeing more of, giving them control over their information that goes up online. So I did a little video on this today for our digital daily series, and people can check it out at hashtag VOA on Twitter. And at facebook.com/hashtag VOA if they want to learn more and see my lovely face and not just hear my voice.
We would love it. And thank you so much for that. And so what else is happening?
Well, a big milestone to talk about. And this is a follow-up to a story that we talked about a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
You might remember that we talked about Despacito. The
yes, I do.
Song, and how it became the most streamed song
yes,
in
yes.
history. And we talked about how it was on its way to potentially becoming the most watched YouTube video ever.
Right.
Well,
has it happened?
It has happened. It is now the most viewed YouTube video in history. And before it reached that milestone, it actually hit another milestone, the first video to get more than 3 billion views on YouTube. So two big milestones for Despacito, the music video. It took just 204 days to reach that mark.
I feel bad. I'm not one of the people that contributed to that. I have not seen it. But
you know, in all honesty, I hadn't either until early on Monday. I went and when I saw the story, I said, let me go through and watch that video. So I have contributed my one view to that 3 billion. But it is not the only video in the 3 billion club, because not long after it hit that mark, the music video for the song See You Again by Charlie Puth and Wiz Khalifa, which was previously the most viewed video, also crossed the 3 billion view threshold. So right now, these are the two videos that are over 3 billion views on YouTube, with Gangnam Style by Psy not too far behind. Of course, that was the long time most viewed video until that was overtaken. So all these videos getting a lot of views, a lot of clicks online. Kind of surprising maybe that these would be the three that would get this much attention. But that Psy video is very interesting. It's got a lot of fun stuff. The Despacito video, of course, it's a hit song, so everybody wants to see that and hear that. And See You Again, another big song.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, vocal cord problems strike again in the country music concert scene. This time it's stricken one of our beloved female country icons, Faith Hill. Nikki Strong of VOA 1 joins International Edition's Sarah Williams on what's happening with the superstar.
Well, she's on tour with her husband, Tim McGraw. They're doing their Soul to Soul World Tour. And the doctor has just demanded that she takes just 2 days of vocal rest. 2 days is not a lot, but it's forcing her to cancel her tour stop in Little Rock, Arkansas. So that's a lot of money that's been lost. And neither she nor Tim have commented on the cancellation of the show on their personal social media pages. But the venue has released a statement, and they do say that Tim and Faith adore their fans and are so sorry to disappoint them. That's understandable. And so far, tickets are being refunded. There's no word yet about a makeup date.
Well, artists canceling shows because of vocal cord problems is becoming quite common.
I know. It's wild. Adele did it. Sam Smith, Keith Urban, John Mayer, Jimmy Westbrook of Little Big Town. The list goes on. Some doctors say it's a combination of things. Firstly, record sales are not what they used to be. So artists are really depending on touring to make a good chunk of their income. And so when an artist is also highly successful, there's a lot more that comes along with it. So they have to do more of everything. They have to do more press, more promo. They have to tweet. They have to Facebook. They have to chat. And many times they're touring and recording their next record at the same time, a lot of times at night. So it's very taxing. And on top of it all, a lot of singers just don't take care of their instrument, whether they're on or off the road. So they have to, there's a certain way they have to eat. If they drink it all, you know, if there's any drugs involved, if they smoke, that also impacts their vocal ability. And it becomes just a recipe for disaster.
Well, Faith also hasn't released a studio album in more than 9 years.
Yeah. So even though she's a vet and she's been very active during that time, this is not their first Soul to Soul tour. So she's been performing and she's been singing and she's also has done music. But her and Tim just signed a new deal with Sony Music Nashville that includes a duet album as well as multiple solo recordings. So Speak to a Girl is their first single, and their joint album is supposed to be released later this year. So the hustle, I think, is really kicking in on a higher level. So I think it's imperative that both of them, Faith and Tim, take care of themselves.
Oh, it sounds like it. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you can hear music from both Faith Hill and Tim McGraw on VOA One's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook and Twitter at VOA One The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Because that's how you talk to a woman. That's how you speak to a girl.
Well, that does it for today's international edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Homemade bombs, known as improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, are used by terrorists not only to attack opposition military forces, but also, increasingly, to harm civilian populations. As a world leader in clearing explosive hazards that threaten civilians, the United States is taking action to tackle these deadly devices in Iraq, Syria, Colombia, Afghanistan, and elsewhere around the world. According to the Landmine Monitor, an annual report by a non-governmental organization, person-activated IEDs and improvised landmines caused 1,075 casualties in 2014 and 1,331 casualties in 2015. IEDs are a particular threat to both military personnel and civilians as they enter areas previously occupied by terrorists. For example, during the final months of the battle for Mosul, ISIS sowed the city streets with IEDs to prevent civilians from leaving. Later, as they retreated from the city, the terrorists set thousands of IEDs around critical infrastructure like power and water utilities, schools, and hospitals. Non-state armed groups such as ISIS and the Taliban often use IEDs to destabilize peace operations and terrorize civilian populations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, writes Stephanie Pico, a public diplomacy officer at the U.S. Department of State. ISIS also has deliberately placed IEDs before retreating from an area with the intent of prolonging insecurity, inflicting additional casualties on communities struggling to recover, and delaying economic redevelopment in liberated communities long after direct ISIS-instigated hostilities in those areas cease. The United States is the world leader in conventional weapons destruction, including humanitarian demining, having invested over $2.8 billion in projects in more than 100 countries since 1993. In addition to humanitarian demining, the United States' counter-IED efforts work to disrupt networks that use IEDs and train the forces fighting those networks to identify IEDs and protect against them. Counter-IED differs from humanitarian demining in that it focuses on deterring, detecting, and preventing IED employment before threats become imminent, writes Stephanie Pico. Working with our allies in the international community, she writes, the United States will continue to develop strategies to address the IED threat to prevent IED users from carrying out their nefarious plans and achieve peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.